think we could probably get him to look at your book. And in ink, it's you, so...
Rolling. Keep them doggies rolling.
Wow, man, that's horrible that you went to something cool like Rawhide and I went to Fred Durst.
Keep rolling.
Did you see his new look? Like, did he debuted last summer at Lollapalooza?
Oh, I don't know if you saw, but Norm Macdonald died.
Norm Macdonald died?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, like, I just saw it, like, on the Facebook.
I'm not like, tragically unhappy about that, but he was funny.
He was funny in his
repertoire, like, yeah, when he did his thing, but then he disappeared. Like, I don't remember.
He had a show online, I think, which was, like, a talk show, and it was really funny.
Okay.
But, yeah, I was a little bit
sad. I loved him when he did, like, this SNL news. He just had that voice, that deadpan. Sad. Well, in honor of Norm Macdonald, what are you guys talking about? All right, everybody. So welcome to the show proper. I will probably keep in a bunch of that early stuff. But thank you all for joining us for yet another What Are You Guys Talking About? We are on episode, I believe, is 94.
Yep.
So today we're going to talk about Joker. And a bit of a preface with that. Ed and I avoided Joker like the plague when it came out because we didn't like the mixed reviews. At least I didn't like the mixed reviews. It came out in an era where Trump was king. And people like this, like are described in this movie, and I'm not giving you spoilers, you probably know more about the movie than I did, even after watching it once, you know, but it just was not the right zeitgeist for me to watch the film. So yeah. I avoided it, said I wouldn't watch it, not because it was a bad film, but because I think it would color the way I saw it. I now completely 100% agree with him. I'm glad that I waited to watch it.
Me too.
You know what I mean? Yeah, because I have a lot more I can say about why I hated it when it came out and why I think, you know, now it's better. But that's what we're talking about today. Mm. Before we get too much into it, let's go back to make sure that we talk about brass tacks, everybody. And all that means is, remember, you should be checking out us on the webpage that we have, www.lovevictoriaproductions.com. That has all of the podcasts, all of the Dirty 20 videos. It has our short films. It has our trailers for our new films coming out. You know, I'm about to kind of shake things up, I think, a bit, because we have more definite plans on when the feature is going to come about. And I'm just saying it on air for the first time, so Ed's going to be like, what? I'm going to say, I think we need to get a short in between that.
Maybe.
It may be. I've got a couple that are pretty much ready to go. And actually, by doing the feature, I've learned now what I need to do for the short. So it's all part of the process, baby. So just keep watching that page, because there may be some announcements coming up as to things we need to be doing. So, with that in mind, you can also catch us on social media. We are on Facebook with Love Victoria Productions, Jason Chereau, which is Cherot, Edward Burgos, or you can catch us on Instagram with Anano LVP or Jazzy J Chereau. At Twitter, we are at Mouth Love Victoria or at Ananoski Prod. And finally, you can find us on a LinkedIn page called Love Victoria Productions. Oh, and TikTok LVP Film Life, which has slept because I've been so busy with my day job for the past couple weeks now. So, with all that in mind, so we're going to be talking about Joker, but let's start with our usual first impressions. So,
do you want to talk things we watched first?
I don't know. I always like to do the first impressions, okay, then it gives them that buffer in between of things we watch, because I have a lot of things we watch this week.
Yeah, same.
Always. And then we'll finally get on to the topic of the film at the end there. So first impressions for Joker, though. So we're not going to spoil anything that happens in the film. I think, to be fair, there's not too much that is spoiler-ish. If you read the synopsis of this thing and you know who the Joker is, then we're not really going to kill it for you. But, like, who, and I always put this to you because I feel I'm a bad person on this, but who do you think should watch this and who do you think shouldn't watch this?
I think that if you're a cinephile, if you're a big fan of people like Martin Scorsese, I think that you will appreciate this. Mm. I think that the average comic book fan might not enjoy this quite as much, but there's also some stuff in here which actually, because one of my big gripes was, do I want a Joker origin story? There's a lot of really good stuff in here. You know, it was a good film, but that's what I would say. If you're a cinephile, if you like your gritty Martin Scorsese type of drama, then I think this fits in that category very well.
Yeah, I would agree. It's the kind of thing, if you are looking for something, like I just, you know, this morning before I was eating my Wheaties for breakfast, I was watching Fast and Furious 8, which those movies, I can't stop watching them, but they get increasingly ridiculous. But then I sat at Fright Fest and talked to everybody else about it, expecting them to be like, the other old shit. And we were all like, don't we love those films? So that's the type of film you're looking for, like, for this week. Yeah, like, no. Yeah, Joker is not that. This is it may have a comic book name, but this is going back towards more of like, and I don't even want to put it towards like the Frank Miller stuff. This really isn't a comic booky film at all. That's why it's different.
If you kind of hate comic book movies, I think you might really enjoy this one.
Man, that's, there we go. Boom, trademark it, because that's it. That's it. This is like a comic book film for people who hate comic book films, because there's just nothing comic booky about it in the whole sense of it. However, it's one of the most interesting nemesis in all of, you know, it's my favorite, you know, guy.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest bad guys of all time. I've got four Joker books in the house,
you know, one that's literally just on the different personas of Joker. Right. So, and again, it's like Ed said, the reason that the fans don't usually like this film is it's an origin story, and as you know, Joker's not supposed to have an origin, or he has a variety of them.
Yeah, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on, because I think they did a very smart thing with the film. But I agree with everything.
That's the thing. It's a film. And that's, if you're expecting it to be like a world expanding, whatever, like new. I would also say, like, some people wanted to watch this for like the political machinations. I think it's not, now that we're out of like kind of the big stink that was going on when this came out.
Right,
do not think the political machinations are nearly.
It's a different time.
That's my first impression, bitch. Listen, I'm going to put it straight up, because I'm not going to be sour about the film. I'm going to tell you what I liked later, but what I didn't like, and the stuff that will piss people off, is there is umpteen Joaquin Phoenix is waving his hands around as if it meant something, when I'm like, what in God's name is going on now? Okay, that's what I mean. Like, if you think this is going to tell you some sort of big message about something, I thought Spider-Man Homecoming did it better.
I know I'm
pushing the boat way out on that because this was an Oscar-nominated film.
It's a very different. They're doing very.
But there's
very
a layer things. Of pretentiousness to this film that they couldn't get away from, 100%. And I'll talk about it on the podcast. Yeah. And it's not. I actually liked the film.
Yeah.
But it was ever present in this film.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. First impression. So that's it. Said, watch it with warning. Maybe you want to watch it just so you can be like me, just so you can get on and bitch about it, you know, later on. Because it wasn't a bad film. It's not something that I would say it's so horrible, don't watch it. I would say watch it just so you can understand whether you liked it or not. Mm. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it's one of those. It's one of those that you're not really going to know if you like it until you watch it.
Yeah.
Which says a lot for it, I think.
Yeah. All right. So what are you watching this week?
I watched some really cool stuff. I got to watch a documentary, which is like an ESPN original.
Okay.
About Real Madrid, my football team.
Whee!
And a period of time that was like central to our history, which you might have been in Madrid or in Spain at that time, like back in the early 2000s.
Yeah, this is probably when I went to my only claim to fame is that I've been to a Real Madrid Barca game.
Oh, wow.
And the best part is, because they told me, they warned me before I go in there, Jason, have you been to a Spanish soccer match before? I'm like, dude, like, no, I go to American football. That's what I do. And they're like, okay, so all you're going to hear is, fuck Barcelona. And that's all you did hear. Like, the entire time. It was amazing. Because that was such a big, you know, for European standards, that was such a big stadium, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So, no, I mean, it was breathtaking. So, this is during that period then, yeah?
Yes, during that period, it's called Los Galácticos, and it's a really, really good sports documentary. ESPN have been doing some really cool stuff. They do a series called 30 for 30.
Yeah, everyone in America, well, not everyone in America, if you like your sports, 30 and 30 is like your educational documentaries.
They do some really cool stuff. Like, they did one called The Two Escobars, and it was about Pablo Escobar and the other Pablo Escobar, who was a Colombian soccer player who was murdered for scoring an own goal.
Yeah.
Not too long ago.
That happened.
That was 94. That was USA 94.
Yeah.
But I got to watch that. I also watched Lower Decks, which is season 2, the first 5 episodes. It's fantastic. Star Trek animation for the real Trekkie.
Okay, yeah, let's break it up, because I've watched the first 5 episodes of season 1 now, because you recommend it, because I am a Trekkie. I'm a total Star Trek nerd. This, I would say, is very much, what is it, the Trekkers are the Next Generation people?
Yeah,
and I think the Trekkies are the originals. This is more of a Trekker, I would say.
This has references to all of Trek.
Everything,
but It's very, like, if you're a, you know, DS9, it's, next
it's
gen.
It's clearly, the writing room is clearly, like, this is when you smile a bit. Like, these are people like us. They are people that were in their young age watching Next Generation, probably with their parents at night. Mm-hmm. And now they're kind of looking back. And why did they never... I just like the take on it. So, to explain what it is, because I think that's the one thing they haven't done really well at fucking all on Amazon Prime. Like, this is, like, one of the criticisms of Star Trek is that it's always this... utopian society that wouldn't fucking... I completely agree. And Picard tries to poke a hole in that a little bit by retconning, you know, earlier Star Trek. This does a better job and just says, no, it's not that it doesn't exist.
Right, so it's
you don't see it. So now we're going to introduce you to the maintenance crew.
Stupid things, the silly...
know, and it works so well because you realize, obviously, it's still Star Trek, so they still have all these adventures and crazy shit, but then it... You know, the only thing I will say, it's riffing very heavily left off like Rick and Morty. You know what I mean?
It's got a very heavy Rick and Morty episodic,
Final Space, crazy shit just happened kind of vibe. Yeah. But, you know, take it and run with it because it's a part of Star Wars that should have been done. Star Trek. Mm-hmm. That should have been done. It hasn't been done.
Yeah.
You know, the jokes about the Ferengis, man, there should be like whole shows about jokes about Ferengis.
And they like referenced the Zinkethi, which were the cat people from the original series animated show. Like, the references are endless. It's so much fun. I recommend it to any Trek fan.
And I would recommend it as like that. To be fair, like I even think that it's weird to me that it seems like almost non-Trek fans would even love it even more.
Like, yeah.
Like you can take it one of two ways. The comedy is actually, that's where the only thing that I thought it missed its mark. Mm. And it's not because it's a bad show, but because I think this is why it's not topping the charts. This is a segment of Trekkers. You know what I mean? Like, some Trekkers will watch this and be like, this is sacrilege.
Some of the jokes landed a little flat as well, like in the first season. I think they polished it up so much better in the second season.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking forward to get to it then. And they're only 30-minute episodes, guys. So again, that's where I'm always like, just give it a whirl. That's literally 2.5 hours of your time, 5 hours you want to watch both seasons. Get it done.
And one of my favorite Next Generation episodes is called Lower Decks, and it's where they follow the younger crew. Like, kind of similar to this, but obviously, you know, in TNG kind of way, where there's, like, a message. That's what I loved about this,
because this makes fun of TNG all the time. Talking about, like, the message and the, you know, the missions and all this. And it's like, you know, now we live in this postmodern society where we're all like, this was all really dumb.
I also watched a musical on Apple Plus.
This is the one you were telling me about.
Yeah. Come From Away. Mm. And it was really fun. We talked about Schmigadoon and the musicals that we love and stuff like that.
That was almost appropriate timing for you.
Yeah, I know, right? But what I found really interesting is, and especially like talking about Joker, which is, you know, a film of a that came out at a particular time, right? This feels like the kind of entertainment that I think audiences are going to gravitate more towards in the coming years, the kind of really feel-good stuff. It's about 9/11, feel-good stuff. But it's where all the planes got grounded in Newfoundland, in Canada, in like an old, like giant airport. And they basically doubled the population of this area of Newfoundland in the couple of days immediately after the attacks.
Right.
And it's all the story. Yeah, and it's all the stories of the people who were there. Like, and it was really uplifting. I kind of put it on thinking, oh, I'll watch a little bit, kind of like what I did with Hamilton. I watch a little bit, and then I watch a little bit when I'm in the mood.
Yeah.
But I just sat through the whole thing. It was brilliant.
Well, I it's definitely piqued my interest. It's definitely on my list now for that one. It's another musical from Apple, and they did deliver on Schmigadoon. So hoping this one will follow. As I said, it's funny because I have to pull myself out of Apple sometimes.
You know
what I mean?
That's kind of why I jumped on Lower Decks.
We almost said today was almost going to be... I pulled Joker at the last minute. Originally, it was going to be Corman because I watched all of that in like a day.
Yeah. Is it good?
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, it's just another... this is the thing. Like, now that I'm watching so much of Apple, I'm like, it's another take. Like, it's another... They're very good at giving like different vignettes on things. And this is a vignette on a guy around our age who is a fifth grade, you know, teacher, and like what is his life like. You know, it's dealing with all that. I call it the 30 somethings because I remember, you know, The Big Chill and 30 something the show came out for my parents, dealing with the same kind of issues. We've almost like, you know, our generation, it's 10 years later that we're all coming up to this age where it's like, have we done anything with our lives? Mm-hmm. Is it supposed to be this way?
Right.
Are we going to be okay?
It's very existential for kind of
it was. Gen that's X's, what that's what it was for boomers yeah. back then. You know what I mean? It was the yeah. whole the big chills, the big one on have we achieved what we set out to do? Is it right that we were hippies and now we're like corporate people?
Right.
And
right,
so that's happening to us. We were all comic book geeks and whatever else we were in our youth, and now it's like, well, the world's falling apart. Are
yeah,
we doing
can't
this?
Afford houses. We can't. Yeah.
yeah, you know, mundane life catches up with you. So I think that's why that you know, Corman still seeks to think about that in our terms. It doesn't go back to like the boomer practicalities. It goes on to. It's a bit, you know, it's the reason Garden State blew the water out for the 20-somethings when it came out, because right. that was something that really spoke. It was funny because that came out while Ed and I and Becky were in Korea, and I don't think that could have explained our lives like what it was like being that age any better of just not knowing anything about what you wanted to do with your life but just waiting for the adventure, you know?
Yeah, yeah, 100%. That was actually a really seminal film for me.
Yeah, I loved Garden State.
And then last couple of things that I watched this week, one was Beauty and the Beast, the live action version.
Yeah, which I said I've never seen. I've got to catch it because I caught bits and pieces with my daughter and was like, this is really good.
It is. It's really good. Emma Watson's amazing. It makes me sad that she's kind of, you know, going on to do other things besides acting, which is great for her. But I think we're going to miss a couple
of things.
As
I say, I know it's a hard thing for a guy who changed into film when he was 38, you know? Like, I get it. Like, you've done one thing your whole life.
Right, yeah.
You want to try something different. Like, I totally get that kind of stuff. So, you know, all power to it. As I said, Emma Watson, if you ever listen to the podcast, like, you are my daughter's hero. You know, she loves Hermione Granger, but then I told her the story about Emma Watson putting books on people's things. And it's just everything that, you know, it's a really good role model when you've got a daughter to say, well, this is a person that, you know, grew up in the in the spotlight,
and you can like point this is like you say, this is a good role model for you.
Yeah, strong, you know what I mean? Like that's the thing. It's the things I like about Emma Watson as an actress, and this is stuff we do talk about as producers, is like, it's an easy way for me to, I don't have, there's not going to be any pushback with an Emma Watson, you know what I mean? She's a strong, she's opinionated, but not, you know, not someone that forces her opinion down your throat. But she stands up for what she believes in, and you know what you're going to get. There are too many problems when you have other, you know, major cast members that you're just not sure where it's going to fall, stuff like that. So,
yeah.
So you know what I mean? I just think that's where staying power is when it comes to money. We've talked about what these people are worth when it comes to putting them into a film. And as an indie filmmaker, you're never going to get any of them, so don't worry about it. But if you are putting together that big film, you know, we talked about how some of them don't end up being worth the money you pay for them. And I do believe, you know, based on the fact that I look at this every week, that there are ways to determine that. You know, you can look at kind of the earning power. Some of that comes from the Natalie Portmans and the Emma Watsons, where you have that kind of fan package because they are such strong individuals as well. So
Yeah.
Anyways, long run.
No, but it was good. I didn't feel quite as moved with the musical numbers. It felt very kind of rehashing of nostalgia, which I think is kind of what was going on for a little while there.
I'm pretty sure that's why. I mean, The Lion King, you know, Jon Favreau, I always hate saying this because I've never actually watched it.
I haven't either, yeah.
But it was literally just given to me as a nostalgia trip.
Yeah.
Minus the fact that it has Jay-Z and Beyonce. Just Beyonce. Why do I think Jay-Z was in there?
Because he goes wherever she goes.
Exactly. No, but it has Beyonce as...
But it has Atlanta writer-director as well.
Oh, that's right.
He plays Simba.
Yeah. Why can I remember the name now?
Glover. Donald Glover.
There you go. Donald Glover. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's there should be no reason I don't like it, but then when it was pitched to me, it's a shot-for-shot remake of the original. And this is from a parent who has watched the original with his daughter, because we went to see The Lion King last year, like, over and over and over and over again. So I might just need some time from that movie before I watch it again, and I'll be like, okay, it was fine.
Yeah. I feel like it was... And again, John, we love you to bits, but it was him kind of pushing technological boundaries, you know, which I think is partly what kind of got him into The Mandalorian and stuff like that. But yeah, the final thing that I watched on Amazon Prime, which I got for Lower Decks, but I spotted this and I've been wanting to watch it for a while. It's called The Eye of the Beholder. And it's the art of Dungeons and Dragons, interviews the staff artists and the art directors from the TSR days, that really iconic artwork that is fantastic. And yeah, this was a really, it was a fun one. For any D&D fan, I recommend it.
No, I love all that subgenre stuff. I mean, that is subgenre. Like, it reminds me of Magic Gathering. They always have the side tables, like seven tables of all the artists, because some people only follow that game because they love the artwork. And I'm the kind of person, I would say that there's a lot to be said of that. When we go into, you know, our indie filmmaker listeners like us, the ones that are writing or the ones directing or making films and stuff like that, listen, don't discount stuff like that. That is probably, at least from my standpoint, the best sources I have of information. And it's not always just the pictures, but it can be. And so
it's, that's what I mean. It's inspirational, isn't it?
It has to be. Yeah. And that's what I mean. Like, at the moment, for me, because I'm working on this into the script that I'm writing, like, I went to my favorite, like, occult and crazy bookstore, which is not, it's just in London, guys. It's not like it had, like, Satan waiting for me at the door. But I bought this Journal of Ars Magica because I just like the cover, to be honest with you. It was the first day, it was expensive as fuck, too.
Yeah.
You know, this is typical. Jason walks in and just says, I'll have that. Yeah, and then they tell me how today is, like, well, good thing I got a credit card.
It's like at a Fright Fest when I saw the Western book.
Yeah, and you're like,
and you were like, you're gonna get it.
You gotta get it. You gotta
stop pretending like you're.
Well,
not
because I believe, like, this is all part of, you know, probably why I shouldn't be reading books about the occult. But like, this is all stuff calling to you. You know what I mean? If you've seen something that catches your eye, you know, this is the stuff that you're gonna want to write about, that you're gonna want to talk about. So look into it. I'm telling you, like, this is a 30-page magazine, which only has probably 5 pictures, and the writing is dense as all fuck. But it's amazing the kind of stuff that I want to be able to pull out of this and turn it into a scene or turn it into something, because
just
it'll
give inspire
me a,
something.
It'll
that
give
spark.
Me a visual. Yeah, that's why I read all those comic books. Comic books, again, for me, are one of the best sources for, because everything in a comic book is short and quick.
So
you just have to, like, look at things that way. And how can you set up a story fast? I'm just trying to say to you, like, that's how you expand your horizons. D&D and anything role-playing game is another great way to do that, because again, it gives you the framework. In that situation, the reason we participated in it so much is it always gives you a nice background to work from. Ed is creating, basically, every time he walks in there with a campaign, but then he does it with some players. So.
Yeah, and you know, the pictures inspire things. Sometimes you look through the monster manual and you pick a monster exclusively because of the picture, not because of anything else. You just want to pull up that book and show your players and say, this is what you're facing.
And that's the thing you notice when you're playing D&D, Ed. That's the thing I love the most is... It's always descriptive. Why? Because no one's going to play that game. Actually, I shouldn't say that, because Scott was telling me about a particular guy that's all he does is roll the dice. And that's all he wants to do is fight. But for most players, like, the whole point is telling the best story. And so, you know, I still remember
the one shot where
Scott, you know, covers himself in shit for half the damn thing. And then all you could talk about. And it was hilarious, but it's a very visceral image. It's a very mental image, right? Mm. And that's what made me think, because your villains from both the one-shots as well are well thought out that way. One is clearly, you know, trademark Pennywise, right?
But very obviously inspired by a certain Stephen King.
Certain crazy clown. Yeah. But in the same sense, it was the way you describe it is iconic, and that's why, you know, I mean, that's why you need the pictures. You know what I mean? So it all works to kind of, you know, stew that mind up. You know, if you're a straight producer only worried about the numbers, maybe you don't have to worry about the pretty pictures then. But for the rest of us in indie filmmaking, it's a necessity to kind of get that inspiration from somewhere. Anywhere. You know, just whatever gets you.
Amen. Amen.
Cool.
Speaking of crazy clowns.
I know. Should we move on to Joker? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, is there anything that you watched that you wanted to talk about?
No.
We didn't really get to talk about Candyman last time. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, we can talk about... Yeah, I watched a couple of things in the past, haven't I? So Candyman... We can do. I did Candyman last time, didn't I?
I don't think we.
We were really tired. Yeah, I'm pretty sure we talked.
Okay,
about Candyman.
Okay, fair enough.
If I haven't talked about Candyman, somebody put it in the comments and I'll put it in. Because Candyman, the short version, like, adequate, like, not definitely not my favorite Jordan Peele film at all. Not a bad film by any means, but also didn't really scare me. Like, just didn't. I'm waiting to see Malignant, and I want to kind of compare the two, because Malignant from the trailers looked like crap to me, and I said this is gonna be James Wan's one that I don't like, because it didn't look very interesting. Now everybody who's gone to see it has been like, it's amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
I really like James Wan.
There's some twist in it that I didn't know, you know, that's not in the trailer, and that's how he does it. He gets you in and you're like, oh, just
even help. Even the ones where you're like, I don't know, Insidious, for example, where you're like, oh, okay, right. Story wise, there's still
and,
some
yeah, I know the story is really simple and it's dumb in Insidious. Yeah, it really, like, I remember describing it to Becky and she was like, that sounds really dumb. I'm like, it does, but then it actually works. You know,
really
like
well.
The visual on it is so well done.
Yeah.
So I watched Candyman. I enjoyed that. Went on the date. You know, thank you very much for watching the kid while I went on a date with my wife.
Yep.
But no, the other one I watched, I talked to you about, was Alpha Dog.
Yes.
And I would make a mention to that, guys. Like, if you can get through... First of all, not to spoil it, just read the read what it's about, and you'll understand that I'm not spoiling it for you to say, like, you have to avoid the big death, because it was really over the...
Who's in it, or who directed? Is it, like...
I don't know who directed it, but this is Justin Timberlake's, like, acting debut.
Oh, that's right.
And that's why I said, like, I had to watch it, because I remember, as I said, I used to work in a music store and do his promo and stuff like that, and I remember this was the one everyone was talking about and saying, oh my god, have you seen him in this? Like, he does a really good job. He does. He does a really good job. It's not a very woke film, and that's another reason I think it fell apart when it came out, because, you know, you're dealing with... I think it's a bit unfair, though, to say that, because this is a community in California, a huge community, one that I used to hang out with, not the drug addicts, but, like, the surfers, the crazy ones, the, like, whatever, like, I could see myself at these parties, and it was like, yeah, I remember, you know, being around there. And that's basically what it is. It's a party film that has, like, one of the worst endings known to men, because that's the whole point of the film, is that it gravitates toward this.
Right.
But I just would encourage people, like, the acting is strong and good. Yeah. And that's why I'm, like, saying this. Like, normally I would say...
I've always been a fan, I'll be honest.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I would normally say that because of that death, which it's as I said, it's the guy that you think is going to die, he's going to die, and it's going to be horrible. So skip that. Like, literally just jump over it, because it takes the film in a completely different direction. And it's one of those things, I don't know if it's fair or not to criticize the film for that, because the film is open that it's going to do this to you.
Right, it's like, it's not hiding.
It put it in the synopsis this is a bad day, this ends in tragedy, not comedy. But the problem is there's so many instances where it could have just pulled away, and we're going to get Ashley McCarthy on the show, who's written a book that we're helping promote at the moment, and we'll talk about adaptation. Like, there are times, I think, when you have to move away from the source material and say, no, we're going to do this a little differently. This was a real life event, and so it's like, maybe you could have just changed... You know, this is... I told you I had one of the greatest conversations this week at a charity function I went to. And somebody asked me, like... I got to talk film with a bunch of people who had nothing, knew nothing about film. Mm. And the coolest person in the world comes up to me and asks me, so what's the point of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Oh, yeah.
And then, sorry, like, if you don't know what the point of that is, he's telling a fairy tale. He's telling you what he had hoped had happened. And we talked about this on the podcast when we did it, but that, the view, you know, the whole of spoiling this completely for you if you haven't seen it, but Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was supposed to be like, this is how it should have happened.
Right.
This is how it should have gone down.
Right.
And that's why it's so beautiful, because by not doing that, what really happened ended Hollywood, ended 70s Hollywood the way it was.
Right.
It was never quite...
the death of that kind of innocent...
That era.
Innocent time.
Yeah. And so, like, that's why I just love that film. That's my hangout film, as we always
call it. Yeah, it's, you know, we talked about it on the podcast. Not my favorite Tarantino, but I do recognize that it is a good film. Definitely.
But that was it for me. Like I said, Alpha Dog, it's on Prime at the moment. That's the only reason I recommended it as well, as it's free. The moment you've got Prime. So go ahead and check it out. Just skip the last, 5 minutes and then get to the conclusions. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I think that segues perfectly into Joker.
Okay.
Let's
do it.
Did you like this film?
Yes. By the end of it, I really liked it.
Good.
I thought it was a fantastic film. I actually liked it from a comic book perspective, because it didn't do what I thought it was going to do. So yes, I really, really liked it. You?
Yeah. I think I was much the same way on it. I think as a film, it held up. I put it, for me, into the... And if you know me and you listen to the podcast, you understand. If this is your first podcast, you're not going to get this at all. But it's in my Scorsese category. I don't tend to like Scorsese films. Like, listen, like, this isn't me mad at Martin Scorsese.
No,
Scorsese is a closet racist. Like, he puts a lot of... He always puts these scenes that, like, anybody who's of color will be like, why did you set it up like that? Why? Just watch his films and how many times he drops the N-bomb and thinks it's fine. And it's like... It's different if it was a mixed race or a black director, but he just loves to do it and then loves to be like, it's fine because my films are cool.
He's from a certain time, isn't he?
Exactly. And he's a New Yorker, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I get it, because my family's New York. You know what I mean? I get it. It's just that aspect of Joker was prevalent to me. And it was like, this is interesting. You know, especially because we're talking about Gotham City, right? Which is, to this day, still remains one of the least blended cities, you know, I've ever seen. I don't know why DC just can't do what Marvel's doing and just, like, you have to retcon it. Why? Because...
It's a different time.
It's a different time now. Guess what? They say by 2040, like, haha, there is no majority anymore. Right. Like, you got to get with the times on this stuff, guys, because it's not a joke anymore. And so that was the joke in Joker that I was like... you know, I had heard the criticism that this was like the white man's plight. Yeah. I don't agree with that.
That was going to be
this was not points. A movie about the white man's plight. However, it was clearly directed. Todd Phillips, who directed this one, I just think was directing as a white dude.
Yeah.
Like, he just saw the shots and didn't see some of the problems that are right. Like, well, why are you setting it up that
exactly.
way?
Exactly. Exactly. It was a kind of unconscious thing, which I think is, after having watched it, I think it is an unfair criticism. I think that, you know, because I, like you, I read some of the reviews saying that this was like, you know, a film about how hard it is to be a white male, you know, in the world today. And that does seem very unfair. And again, it feels like because when it came out at like the peak of
it did.
So many
and
things.
And see, I would on. Say if you had situations where every attack was by a person of color, or every time this guy suffered something shit, mm-hmm. it was a person of color, then I might start believing that. But you know, the big catharsis on this happens from three white dudes, mm. and it's three white privileged dudes. So this was more. Yeah. This is more the undercurrent that yeah. I think. A lot of people, especially the type of people who make these criticisms on Twitter mm-hmm. and everything else, are completely missing. This yeah. was about the people I talk about in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. The poor, undeserved, yeah. and yeah. yeah, they are usually white,
yeah.
but this is why they're, you know, they're not mad because they're white, they're mad because they don't think anyone listens to them.
Yeah.
You know, it has nothing to do with the color of their skin.
Yeah.
And yes, some of these people are pushed into being racist because they are told, you know, the same way, you know, the Nazis told, you yeah. know, the people
it's
in Germany.
It's indoctrination. It's
that's how that yeah. works, guys. So that's yeah. why you kind of have to be like, you know, again, Todd Phillips, like, I don't think you did it deliberately, but it's clear that you are like, you didn't see some of these scenes as they were.
As they might be perceived.
Because yes. the way the poverty is distributed and what yeah. you're talking about, yeah, it's yeah, like, yeah. well, mate, like, we try not to do that anymore. Yeah. But, hey, I didn't direct the film, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's like, and white dudes are allowed to have a perspective.
Exactly, yeah, 100%. Kind of interesting that Todd Phillips, a man more famous for Old School, The Hangover, that kind of, like, quite bro-y kind of comedy... kind of comes and does this gritty drama. I was super impressed by the end result.
I think it's interesting you say that, yeah, because I think that's why he's more suited. You know, he's from that era. I think the Joker is one of the ones that you're going to have a real trouble, if I'm honest, updating. Like, making, if you want to bring that into, like, a multicultural whatever, like, the right. Joker's never been a multicultural yeah,
it's a
character.
Tough angle to
it's,
approach.
It's always been like yeah. that poor, beat-up guy. I mean, you can make him from a variety of different countries, yeah. but, you know what I mean? He still is supposed to epitomize the guy he's laughed at. Yeah.
I really dug the themes of, you know, poor versus rich, and also mental health that this film was clearly, like, aiming at. You know,
that's it, and I think that's why I got mad at the criticisms, because I was like, no, you guys have missed the point about this. This is talking about, you know, the people we really do worry about, the crazy man in his house. Like, you know, I had family I thought of when I thought of this, you know what I mean? Because it's just like, that's what happens. The world forgets the poor, the world forgets the you know, anyone who's not on the TV, and that's all this guy wants to do then is have somebody see him and know he is. And the way that plays out, Ed, that's where I'm going back to your original comments, if you're a cinephile, story, okay? Like, this is another one that would be Save the Cat easy, and I'm sure it is. So Google Save the Cat and Joker, and they'll give you the beat breakdown for this, I'm sure. But it is quintessentially perfect Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. Mm-hmm. Like, and it just... God, and that Act 3 really did it for me. That was really like... Because I didn't think they had the balls to go there.
Yeah,
and they did. Yeah. They absolutely did. So yeah. you see some things in Act 2, right? The taxi driver scene, which was stuff I hate. Because I don't... As I said before, the scenes where you have these gaps where we're supposed to be getting inside of Joker's mind or Joaquin's mind, that's the kind of stuff I would have just cut the shit out of that. Because I think it's pretentious. I think we have no idea what a crazy person living on their own would be in that situation. Please don't make them, you know, whatever that black swanning was or something like that. And then it was the taxi driver scene. Like, we get it. We all watched Taxi Driver. We all know what it had to do with another guy who had nobody who cared about him and who lived on his own. But please, let's not reenact.
It's quite on the nose.
That's it. It was just too on the nose. The same way when I talked about Sweet Tooth, I said having the whole thing about a pandemic that kills everybody, bit too on the nose. Like, just
see, but it does make me wonder, because, you know, we are learning currently, like, development cycles on films, right? Like, I could totally imagine that this film was written before 2016, when you know, the election happened, and which, you know, turned into like this bolder, you know, going towards 2018 and 2019 and stuff.
That's right.
And yeah, I just wonder if it was almost like, you know, how we talked about the morning show and how it felt a little bit like a throwback to old, like, you know, TV, you know, the HBO days, the prestige stuff. So
this would be a great, like, this is the cool thing about eras in film, right? And this is why we do the show, why we spend time studying it, because there are these different movements. This goes back to, this would be one to bookend with The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
There, because again, that was an Uber.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Dark Knight and Joker.
Yeah, it's an
right?
Uber seat. There was this era, right? And while this is why we love film, like there was an era, right, that hit right around that time where all the films coming out were like Uber serious.
Yeah.
But they were awesome because they had these, because you were coming out of like Lord of the Rings were these first type of long films that talked about the achievements of what we've done as a society via the Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And it just was seen as, if we can make an epic movie about this, then we can celebrate the fact that we've just passed the 20th century. Mm-hmm. We're all doing amazingly. So you had that, you had Pirates of the Caribbean, Harry Potter, all these like great adventures on like, isn't the world a beautiful place? And then we got positive. Really postmodern
very
about
dark,
it.
Yeah.
So Batman Begins comes out. That's kind of the end of that era, which is a long ass origin story film adventure.
Yeah.
And then it has a slight message at the end. Yeah. And then you get to The Dark Knight, and that's when you hit that peak. Yeah, and that's when we were talking like, no. Mm. Adventure isn't what life's really about anymore. Right. It's about
the darkness,
the pain,
the
darkness, whatever. And then we started making shorter films, thank God. You know what I mean? Like, that was the next era, was to say, I think the films are getting a bit too long.
Yeah.
And so now we're sticking closer to the 90-minute mark. Although, I'm seeing it creep up again thanks to streaming. So, like, Cruella was... I watched that this week.
Oh, yeah.
I watched part of that this week. My daughter and my wife watched a lot. It's great.
Yeah.
Great style, great fun. Mm-hmm. Awesome references to, like, my favorite era of English, like, English, you know, English mod scene.
Yeah,
like, you know...
The 60s, the swinging London.
And just slightly after that. So you're talking, like 1971, that really is, like... one of my favorite eras, because you just get so much, like, things start becoming something else. So, I don't know. Very cool stuff. So, I mean, that's where we were with Joker, is it just... It's a great film.
It really is. And it has a great performance. I mean, I don't know how you feel about Joaquin Phoenix in general. I think he's possibly one of the best, if not the best actor of his generation.
I know. And he's laughing and he's making it because I just don't like him.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, him in this film, but then again, I kept saying to myself, but this is what he always does. Like, he played Johnny Cash doing this.
Yeah, I mean, for me...
He always plays these decrepit characters, and it's just... that's why when people say he's the greatest of all time, that's the only reason I'm like, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, that's a guy who can reverse it into so many different things. Even a Sean Penn, because Sean Penn can do so many different things. Like, I just don't see the versatility in Joaquin Phoenix.
And I agree with you on that. For me, his generation, like the younger guys, guys that came after the Sean Penn.
Yeah, sure.
And Daniel Day-Lewis's. But, I mean, for me, Gladiator.
He plays the heavy Commodus, in that. You know, he's the heavy.
Fantastic.
And he's got the face for it in that one.
also, Her. He is really, really good in that.
But he's pathetic in that, isn't he?
He is, but it's different.
I still haven't watched that, because the voice of her is Scarlett Johansson. Right?
I think you would really dig
it. I know I would really dig it. I know that's the problem, but I don't want to be like, I like Scarlett Johansson as an actress. I don't want to be like, I also like her as my personal phone voice. I also like her as her picture on my phone. I always like her. She just had a baby. Let's leave her alone.
And my favorite of his performances is The Master, which is by PTA, and it's him and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it's kind of based on the Scientology creator, the author.
Aaron Hubbard.
Yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman plays, like, him, essentially.
I still haven't seen this film. And it's the weird one. It's one you can't find. I can always find Magnolia. I can always find Boogie Nights. And I'm not a big, as you've heard from this podcast before, I am not the PTA guy, because I just think there's a lot that comes with his films that I'm not prepared to deal with. But this one has sounded interesting to me from the get-go. I mean, I'm ready to go back through my old PTA and kind of watch them all again.
But I think you would have a different appreciation from a filmmaking standpoint.
Definitely, and that's why I would say that, definitely, because you can't read a book that doesn't mention at least one of his films.
His films are long,
you know, like Magnolia, though. You know what I mean? The amount, it's in all three of the screenplays.
There will be blood, yeah.
So I've seen that. That's one I've watched all the way through. I still, like, this is the problem I have. I had the same reaction to There Will Be Blood that I did to Boogie Nights. I'm like, who cares? And I know that sounds really harsh, but Boogie Nights, I watched, people were like, this is awesome. I'm like, it's about porn stars. What did you think porn stars did?
I mean, yeah, again, he caught me when I was just kind of starting to get into cinematography and camera movement and stuff like that. And he really is like the modern master.
Yeah, I think that's what I need to watch it with the director's hat on rather than the... Because the problem is, from the story perspective, I'm like, I don't think you're telling anything, especially because it's a white guy telling these stories. I'm like...
Yeah, again,
sorry,
it's...
Sorry, porn industry, like, it sucks that, man, you fucked girls for 20 years, so your dick can't get hard anymore. Like, is that surprising to anybody?
Punch Drunk Love, have you seen that?
Haven't. And I heard it's one of... Adam Sandler's, like, greatest phenomenal. Performance. I saw all the trailers for it, and it was all like, but no, I haven't, so maybe I'll give that one a watch. That's what I mean. That was the problem, because I've seen Boogie Nights, and I didn't have the required reaction, albeit I haven't seen that in, like, 10 years, so maybe now I'd
watch it. But to be fair, like, Boogie Nights and There Will Be Blood are his kind of pinnacle films.
That's what I mean. And There Will Be Blood, like, listen, guys, like, you know, oil baron in California during the oil rush, like, what did you expect?
Yeah,
that's the problem, is people have this, like, this perception that, like, the West was won through nice gestures and handshakes.
I think that one has a lot to do with Daniel Day-Lewis and his performance, and the fact that I think he said that he was quitting after that film and stuff like that. But I mean, to bring it back to Joaquin, like, I thought his physicality was incredible. He lost, like, 50 pounds for the role.
Yeah, he did a Christian Bale on that one. So I always remember Christian Bale does The Machinist and the first Batman all within, like, I think a couple, like, a year of one another.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, this is how you kill your body. Like, he goes from being the skinniest guy in the world to being a Hulk.
Yeah,
you know?
It's not healthy, Christian.
That's all right. You know what I mean? Like, you made the money for it, man. All power to you.
I thought his performance was good, you know, like, to have that laughing condition, you know, like, that scene on the bus.
And this is where I'm at with it, and this is the problem. Even with, like, okay, so Boogie Nights, boring. Like, I'm like, I already know about porn stars, and don't ask, but, yeah, I already know about porn stars, whatever. There Will Be Blood, yeah, I know about shitty people, you know what I mean? Like, I've met shitty people in my life. Not interested. Like, that's the whole reason the stories don't work for me, because they just don't grip me. I'm like, whatever. Like, the world's a shitty place. Like, welcome to the world.
Mm-hmm.
He makes me feel for him. Even though I don't like him as an actor, like, I feel for his characters. I'm like, he was so decrepit as Arthur. And you're just like, those scenes where he's losing it, you're like, oh, even him murdering those three people, you're like, why is everybody so up about this? Like,
the beating, the first beating with the sign was tough to watch. The scene where he's doing his clown shtick at the hospital and he drops the gun.
I love that. Like, that was like...
My ass fell out of my...
But that's...
my heart fell out of my
and
ass.
And that's because the acting, like, that's exactly what I'm talking about, what you're talking about. The acting... Okay, so if you're looking at, like, what makes a good actor, getting tips for the indie filmmaker, like, why should I watch this film? What the fuck's the point? The acting in it is top-notch, not just from Joaquin Phoenix. I don't think there's a... You know, Zazie Beetz is probably my favorite character.
She's
just because I'm absolutely in love with her at the moment.
And that twist was just
amazing. And she played it both ways really well. Like, that's the hard part. And that's why I thought she was amazing in this, because you have to believe it when you find that next scene. You didn't even have to hear what she had to say. You could see it on her face that, oh, God, they pulled another reverse on us. He's never been with this girl at all.
Oh.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But that scene, Joaquin Phoenix is acting, because he doesn't drop character at all.
Yeah.
And you would. You drop the gun in the middle of a hospital, like, not a real hospital, but there's a lot of ways you would overdo that or underdo it and fake it up.
Right.
Ed and I have seen it, you know what I mean? This is one of those
That's
ones
really
that you do, like, 100 takes on it, be like, guys, can you just make it look fucking normal? You know, like, it's a gun that's going to drop out, everybody's going to freak out. You know, I don't know how many takes they had to do, but it looked like they had one.
It was beautiful.
And it was like, really, and he had it, and he has that look of fear, and it's like...
And then he puts his finger to his lips to one of the kids and say, you know, don't tell anyone. Like, oh, it was really good.
You know, that's an example, though, that furthers it. You could not have done the third act without Joaquin. So, you know, third act, spoilers here, is, you know, he walks into a studio and it all goes completely straight until the last 5 minutes, and then it literally breaks into chaos.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has to go that way. The timing is so quintessentially, I love that word, quintessentially perfect. Like, if it was any different, that scene would have been, I was waiting for it. I was waiting for like, this is gonna blow up in your fucking faces.
Yeah.
There's no way you can pull this off with it. Unbelievable.
There were a couple of moments in this film where I felt exactly like that.
Yeah, you just thought this is gonna, you know, the scene with the three guys, the first murders, like I was sure that was gonna turn into something stupid. You know, just something like, oh, he's gonna be whatever, harassed again by these guys. And they ramp it right at the right moment. Just at the moment that I was about like, oh, can we stop picking on this poor guy? It was like, oh shit, what is he doing?
For me, it was when they start foreshadowing there's the revelation in the letter from the mother, who's another fantastic actress. And she did a great job in this.
Yeah, anywhere she's in, I always remember her from American Horror Story, but anything she's in, she's phenomenal. She reminds me of my Aunt Gail.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she kind of looks like my Aunt Gail.
She's fabulous. But, so there's a revelation in the film that, that Arthur Fleck, who is the Joker, the Joaquin Phoenix character, is the son of Thomas Wayne. And when that revelation happened, I was annoyed. I didn't like it. And then, of course, it kind of gets twisted on its head again, you know, which I loved.
Right.
Literally, just like you said, you know, where I thought, oh, this is going to blow up in your face. It's going to be predictable and stupid. And it really wasn't.
And that's that Dark Knight kind of stuff. That's that's that play on it to make it believable. The problem people had before the Dark Knight, like, you know, the Dark Knight, what is Dark Knight about? Dark Knight, everyone probably listening to this podcast has seen, but you haven't seen it, is really about the Joker winning. That's the whole point of the Dark Knight, and that's why it's called that, because the last scene in that movie is basically Batman explaining why the Joker wins every time. And so that was the first time anyone had really done that, and sadly the guy who plays the Joker ends up dying. So I mean, that becomes an iconic film.
He nailed that, right?
Like, yeah,
that
obviously was, you know, no one else could have done it, and he dies for his performance. Is why I said I'm not as always as hot on that as other people are, because it's like, well, I would have loved to have seen Heath Ledger now. We could have shared haircut stories, you know what I mean? Like, so that's what I mean. Like, I don't think anyone should ever have to die for these roles, but that's why that hits the place. But this is, as I said, I would watch the two together, do a double feature night and watch The Dark Knight and then watch The Joker, and I think you'll be really happy.
Yeah, but this goes back a little bit to my reticence for watching this, because, you know, we've had the Jack Nicholson, the Heath Ledger, we've had the Jared Leto Joker. Like, we've seen this character, like, quite a bit. And so I was like, really, do we want more of this character? But
And that's the thing. It's the funny that you say that, because, you know, the Zeitgeist. Like, we did, because when the populist movement happened, which, it's not like the populist movement's necessarily over, it just failed, like they always do.
Right.
Like, sorry, guys, just look in a history book. Like, any time the poor come about and say, well, we're not being tread on, and try something new, like, this is what happens. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not, and I'm not trying to be a prick by saying it, I'm just saying, like, they're always doomed to fail because they're not well thought out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, Trump's not around. He could be around again. You know, this is what they're all talking about. So it's an interesting, I think, piece to put in. You know, it's a good movie to put there. And if Trump never comes back again and we don't have the rise of fascism in America again, then it becomes a part in time when we can say that somebody captured this briefly to a certain extent in a film, as to kind of what happens with delusion and that kind of things. That being said, I don't feel the connection to that, at least as direct as the reviewers made out. This isn't a guidebook. This isn't a, you know, that the whole riot of the clowns at the end, that's the one part I thought was done pretty badly, if I'm honest, because there's no explanation, no real background. It's just chaos reigns because the Joker has done that. I think that's the part that the critics are talking about, but that part really is secondary to everything else.
Right, it's kind of not the point.
The only thing they did wrong with that bit, in my view, and this is where, again, as a producer, I always cut sway the things out. I'm not even sure I needed the clowns to be that uprising or anything like that. Definitely the point where they kill Thomas Wayne and Martha Wayne is just dumb. Like,
yeah,
that was
that felt like shoehorning, you know,
it did.
Comic book
it's
stuff.
It's like, oh, we there. Have to talk about this because it's quintessential to Batman's and Bruce, and we've met Bruce Wayne now. Like, just do a Gotham, guys. Gotham talked about lots of things in every episode.
Have you watched a fair
couple,
bit of that?
Not a lot. A couple episodes. I like the fact that it's always like, you know, you're out of the verse, and so you don't have to, like... Again, you don't want the Batman legacy to turn into what I hate about... Or at least I don't want the Batman legacy to turn into what I hate about Star Wars. You have to break the mold of the protagonist sometimes. Mm. Why? Because no one wants to hear the same story. Mm. You know, Superman hasn't been the same Superman for 100 years. Neither is Batman. Mm. You've got to mix it up sometimes. Mm. And you've got to understand that you're not wedded to what you said before. It's a comic book character. It's a mythical hero. So mythical heroes can change their myths if and this tried to do that, and that's why I felt, again, it was a bit of Rise of Skywalker. At the end, I said, but to keep the fans happy, we'll keep this clown riot and this bullshit going on. To keep the Trump fans and it was just like, well, no. Like, if you would have set it up exactly as you did, where he just kills these people on the show and then lock him up after that. The Joker gets out of lockup every single time. Like, it doesn't mean anything to put this guy in prison because he's crazy, right? Mm-hmm. So I just, that was the part of the film that for me, I was like, oh, that's why it's adequate, not amazing. You know what I mean? Because it's a good film, but there were a lot of those elements that I was like, this is producers or somebody. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't the core of the film. This is some extra bit. And it's a pretty big extra bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's critical in the end.
Yeah, like you say, it feels like kind of somebody said, okay, we have to fulfill something with DC. So... You know, let's
producers come and say, oh, the populist movement's getting bigger now. Like, maybe when we talk about the poor fighting back.
Yeah.
And the problem was, it was so ill thought out. It was like, had it had some sort of connection there, but it literally was, he kills somebody and everybody disagrees with kind of like the public debate on it.
I think it's unfortunate timing, you know, in a different decade where with different things happening, I think that, you know, you could have overlooked that as, okay, that's just the comic booky shit. But because of what was going on, I think a lot of people kind of focused on that.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, you know, this would definitely be something. You see stuff like this in, you know, oh, that was something that I saw. Have you seen the new trailer for the Matrix 4?
Yes.
Oh, right?
Yeah.
Right? We all just collectively came in our pants like, it's back. Oh, it's back. It looks Lana. Lana, you're going to be my best friend. I'm going to give you a big kiss. Like... Jesus, like, I totally dogged this film. I said, it's only one of the Wachowskis coming back to it. Obviously, people are out of money. You know, I did my typical producer thing saying, like, why are they doing this?
Yeah.
And then one trailer, and I was like, never mind, I'm completely wrong.
I'm hopeful, but I still have a little bit of... I was just so disappointed by the second and third films.
Yeah, but you almost get the impression from that fourth one that they were as well.
Yeah, like they're like, don't worry about those two.
They brought back Trinity and Neo, which was like, if you read the articles with people going gushing over that, brought them back to life. Like, that's even a start in the right direction, you know, being like, okay, let's not be as nihilistic as we were before.
Right.
It's a brave new world.
It is a brave new world, yeah.
Okay, well, we're coming up to the end, I think, because Ed's going to pass out if I keep him up too much longer. I think we've got a good amount of chime in there. Is there anything else you wanted to add about Joker that you thought people should shot-wise? Okay, well, let's talk him through.
Yeah, the cinematography was really fantastic. There was one particular shot, which was when he was getting mail. It comes very early on in the film. He's getting mail from the mailbox in his apartment building, and I think it's the second time. And you're slowly seeing this kind of like breakdown, right, throughout the film. And they do something visually which is fantastic. So they pull back, they tilt at a Dutch angle. And they put bars out of focus, like, between the camera and the Joker. Like, basically telling you, without telling you, that he feels trapped, right? And just those kinds of little visual storytelling things were throughout the whole thing.
Absolutely. Like it's again, it's the combination of all of them that obviously makes this work. But that's why we're saying this film shouldn't work. Like, there were a million times, because we're critical of it, that we didn't want it to come together, because we're like, oh, I don't like that element, or I don't like that element. But everything is so crisp between the acting and then the shot choice. The shot choice in this one, I would encourage you to look at, because it builds. It's the reason I like The Ring. Not the Japanese version, but the American version, because the version that's made by, and I can't remember the name of the guy now who makes it, it has a very distinctive style. Like, you would know it from the trailer. Like, it looks a certain way throughout. This did that brilliantly.
Yeah, the, like, use of color, the sepia tone to it. Again, you watch any Martin Scorsese film, whether it's Taxi Driver or even like The King of Comedy, that this was very clearly influenced by.
Mm.
And you get that kind of like... dingy and dark kind of...
Which, and that's why, you know, as much as I'm not the biggest Scorsese fan, I do watch all his films, so it's not like I'm not a fan. But you know what I mean? But, like, this showed that maybe he is kind of the right medium. And Todd Phillips is not Scorsese, but it seemed like the right medium for Gotham, the right medium for...
For
especially for the Joker, you know?
Yeah.
I said, again, watch next to Dark Knight and just catch the... You know, Dark Knight is Christopher Nolan, so it's shinier. Mm. Even though that's supposed to be a dreadfully dark film, like, it's still really shiny.
It is. It does have kind of crispness to it.
No,
as I said... Apart from those fight scenes where you can't see anything.
He's not a fan of that. I remember that from the first one more than the second one. The first one...
Yeah,
like,
the first one. All, the first one's the really
bad all these kind of jumping around things and the quick camera shots. Ed Noh is like, no, like, not my style at all. So
the other thing that I wanted to talk about just very quickly, De Niro, how did you feel about him being there?
Perfect, he's supposed to be that was the only weird thing. It's like trying to find a time that this is supposed to be,
right?
Because De Niro is playing like a Johnny Carson, like an old talk show host, where modern talk show hosts are a bit different. So if they wanted someone that was gonna be like a David Letterman or a Jay Leno or even a Conan O'Brien, like, that's the only thing I would say, is it was very hard to place, and I think it was deliberate, that you couldn't quite place, so is this the 70s? Is this the 90s?
There are some kind of, like, there's an allusion to, like, a trash strike, which I think happened in 81 in New York City.
Yeah, so, you know what I mean?
There was, like, also, like, a vigilante who shot some, like, panhandlers in the
80s. Yeah, so it's kind of possible, you know what I mean? Yeah. I mean,
but there's no cell phones,
some things taken out, like, you know, one of the interesting takes on this one as far as reinterpretation is Thomas Wayne is kind of a bastard. I like that, because I was like, yeah, that sounds about more right to me. Thomas Wayne, typically, because they never want to say anything bad in the comics book, because comics are read by kids, I guess. But he's always this, like, really benevolent doctor. Right. He has all this fucking money, and I'm just like, listen, I grew up with lots of people with money, and most of them are just not benevolent like that. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Like, you do get the diamond in the rough that's this just wonderful person that was just born with all this money, but most people with tons of money are shitheads.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because, you know,
Not deliberately, but because of perspective. Because someone with that much money just loses perspective on what it's like to have to struggle. You know, that's the argument of this film. And so I thought... Yeah, why not take Thomas Wayne and do that too? Because how can he possibly understand the plights? I thought the best scenes with that were when he was like praising those three boys. Because that's exactly the kind of stuff that happens, you know? And it's like, because they know nothing about what those kids are really like. But they know the social system. And so, like, that's what guys like that are like. Not because he's a bad guy, but because he doesn't look outside of his own social network, you know?
I did like so I perceived like a final kind of twist. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't say that. I watched, like, one of these YouTube breakdowns on the Joker, you know, that I sometimes share with
you. Yeah, I know you do,
and they brought up an interesting point, which was, you know, that whole thing about him being his son, but then, like, he says, no, that's a lie, blah, blah, blah.
So if we take that to a natural, I'm just going to go in front of you to see if it's the same thing you're about to say. Okay. If you go to a natural next step on the Me Too movement with that would have been the lie that was created because he did sleep with the woman.
Right. And I think it's alluded to in the film, because not only do you see Arthur look at a picture of his mother when she's young, and on the back it says, I love your smile, and then TW, Thomas Wayne, but also, which I thought this was quite a cool pull, so when he steals the medical records of his mother. Shout out to Brian Tyree Henry from Atlanta, who plays the clerk in that. One of my guys.
I love that scene because it just gets so ugly so quickly. He's all of a sudden like, I don't think I should be talking to you. You are actually batshit crazy, aren't you?
Yeah. But he looks at the files and it kind of confirms what Thomas Wayne has said. But in the breakdown that I saw, they kind of paused it and they showed who had signed it. And in the comic books, it was a doctor who becomes a villain later on.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think they do kind of allude to...
It just would be, you're talking about, again, our complaints with that sector of society today. Actually, it's easy because we have it in the news now. Prince Andrew, who should just take his medicine and deal with it, is now pointing for a change of venue. He says, I can't possibly be prosecuted in the US. It's not fair. Like, Prince Andrew, if you're listening, like... Should you be saying this is lawyer? I'm not acting as your lawyer, but listen, the whole world is trying to tell you no. Like, yeah, just don't. It's
time to take.
When you're being accused of raping some, you know, you can deny it if you'd like. That's fine. I don't think many people are believing that, but that is justice, and that is what you're entitled to do, Ed. You know what I mean? I'm not knocking that. Like, it is your right in our society to defend yourself. However, like, saying that it's not that I'm going to get a fair trial in the U.S., like, just not the PR I think you're looking for at the moment. Just my view, you know, and it's just one opinion amongst many. And
thanks God for knows, listening, Prince Andrew.
Yeah, you know, exactly. What thanks for tuning in the show. I'm not, a little question, like, yeah, why is he listening? You know, like, no, there's no... Do you know what I mean? But I saw that today in the paper, and you know, it's just because I'm not anybody's lawyer anymore. I work for an insurance company, so I don't, you know, I don't, I'm not a lawyer anymore. But I was reading that being like, who advised him that that was a decent idea? Like... Ooh, someone's getting paid an awful lot of money to give him bad advice. Mm-hmm. So anyways, but that's where we're going with Thomas Wayne. It was the whole, like, you know, he buried this, there'd be an NDA in place, blah-de-blah-de-blah. It sounds horrible, but it is, unfortunately, morning show true.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's how those things work. Yeah. So, and the thing I think they set up well with that is, again, that happens because of the power struggle. Poor people, like this woman, and like, you know, Arthur, what are they going to do?
Yeah.
He went to the door. He asked. He was thrown out, and no one gave a shit. And so that's the point. Like, if you don't have access to the courts is one thing, but being able to defend your position is another. And with no money, like, that's how difficult it is. You don't, you know, nobody gets to tell you anything about that. So, no, I think it's an interesting theory, and sorry for jumping in front of you on that. I just knew it's probably where that person was going with it, because I felt the same way, saying, you know, this could be a cover-up.
And what did you, what do you think about, because there is also another theory, which is the final scene where Arthur is talking to a doctor, and it's just after, you know, the scene where he killed De Niro, and also the
yeah, getting that's right. Out it's, of it's the... almost like a post, not a post credit scene, but almost like a post credit scene. Right. You're going somewhere else really quick.
The scene opens with him laughing, and she says, "Is something funny?" And he says to her, and he looks into the camera, and he says, "You wouldn't get it." And his hair is not green, so the theory is that actually, this is the Joker doing what he does, which is lie about his origin.
Yeah, no, that's definitely it. So that's the whole point. I mean, these are all the different bits you pull from the different Joker movies. So Dark Knight Returns, the biggest line that everyone always remembers is Michael Caine talking about he's just a person that wants to watch the world burn. That's your archetype. That's the Joker. That is, you know, if you see him anywhere in any comic, like, you don't even have to call him the Joker, but that's who you're talking about if we talk about, like, Carl Jung archetypes. It's the chaos, the person that has no care, just wants, and we love that. A side of us wants to see that, wants to watch the ego take over and watch things just go crazy. But to do that, it has to be almost, it's funny because I'm reading about this and some of the occult stuff that I'm reading, but like, you almost have to separate the ego out of it. So this is a guy that gives up his own identity to become the ego of everybody, the person that gets to do what we all want to do, which is, you know, burn the place to the ground, that tribal, that limbic system kind of like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so to do that, though, he has to become the faceless man. You know what I mean? And so that's why I think that works perfectly and why I do think it works to have multiple origin stories about that. And I like that. In the comic, it worked really well because you'd be like, well, was it... There's even a comic that does this and it's like, well, is it the guy... Because you have the Killing Joke, you have all these different versions of how he becomes who he becomes.
Right.
And the whole thing is like, none of them are true.
Right.
You know, they're all just stories, you know? And you know, you can go into Dark Knight with that because I love it when he tells the stories about how he gets the Glasgow smile.
Yeah, he tells like that. Twice differently.
Differently, yeah, right? Yeah. And so that's the whole point. He's a liar. He's he's the devil. He's the other. That point. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, 100%. I kind of wish they'd made that a little bit more obvious because I didn't really pick that up when I watched it.
I'm not... You know, that's the thing. I don't think they... I think it was deliberately buried because it's the king that would confuse... viewers,
the movie goer,
then Todd Phillips could always sit back on it and say, but when I wrote it, like, I understood this was the Joker, so you know, this is just one possible story, of his.
And I think he literally has done that. That's literally what he said.
I mean, I just the only thing I would say is I'm like really excited now because I want to do, because they're both phenomenal actors. Like, can we please have a who's playing Batman now? He's a phenomenal actor.
Yeah.
Cedric Diggory, Lighthouse guy. Yeah. Robert Pattinson.
Yes.
Which I know some of you are like, what? I'm like, he's an amazing actor. Yeah, and if you haven't seen his good stuff, like Twilight was okay. I love those films, but there's other stuff he's done that'll really blow your mind. Like, just he's phenomenal. Mm. But picture him as Batman versus Joaquin Phoenix as Joker. That would be dope, right? Like,
I must admit, yeah, this thinking about it now, this has got me excited.
Because your other guy's playing the Joker, your boy from Swiss Army Boy.
Paul Dano.
The Riddler. So Joaquin Phoenix is Joker. Then you've got, you know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm talking about, doing some MCU style shit. Yeah. You get some very talented actors. And that's where I think DC could shine. Because they have the ability to...
Please stop giving money to Zack Snyder. I love you, Zack. I'm sorry. But stop giving money to Zack Snyder.
Yeah, that storyline's done. Okay, it was a wonderful idea, but it never worked.
And, you know, let's go down this route, which is taking itself very seriously, but it is, like, cinematically a fucking marvel. Really. Like, the way the film is shot.
That's the thing. Like, fantastic. I just feel like MCU does this once in a lifetime kind of thing with film. And you know what? Like, I have to explain that to people all the time because I became a nerd about it, you know, and I became someone who understood. But yes, what Kevin Feige and Marvel did will not be repeated in film history for a very, very long time. Like, it's one of those things that it just came together, and that's why someone asked me, you know, at this thing I was at, you know, who's your favorite producer? And it would be like, Kevin Feige, hello? Yeah. Like, or you know, Victoria Alonso, or...
just the MCU guys.
The MCU guys, because they accomplished something that's nigh on impossible, you know, in one person's lifetime. And everyone's
trying to copy it now.
And that's what I'm saying, don't. Like, just don't. Yeah. Stuff that's cool like that, I've learned as a creative, and I've only been a creative for a couple years, right? But don't copy the cool. Try to do something else that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good idea. This is how they layered it. This is how they put it together so they could put this massive story arc together that's still running today. It's like a machine now. Yeah. It just churns out more good stories for you.
Yeah.
DC could do that, but you can't do it the same way that Marvel's doing. It won't make sense. No.
And Batman just has that darkness to it. That inherently in it.
He's the only one without superpowers, you know?
So lean into it hard.
Right.
The trouble is that I think that you're also dealing with a fandom, and as we've talked many times on this podcast, fandoms can be bad,
toxic
for a franchise.
This is why I'm interested to see Dune, because I don't know if fandom will kill Dune, because I've heard like the reviews are already out, which sucks. Mm. Like, please, can we stop doing that? Like, it's not out over here for another 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and it's like already you can literally read whether you're going to go or not.
Yeah.
I hate that shit.
It is tough, because I think that one of the reasons why we didn't watch this was because of the early reviews.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And this is what they're saying about Dune, is that it gets you and then it leaves you. And I'm like, I think it's going to do adequately exactly what it needs to do. Mm. The problem is you got to cut large swathes of the book out because you cannot express them in an adaptation.
I have a lot of faith in Denis Villeneuve. I know a lot of people were disappointed by Blade Runner 2049, but hell no. I thought it was beautiful. It was too long.
I don't know.
And I thought the story meandered a little bit, but...
Definitely. The only thing I would have liked is to have like a nice warm couch in the cinema, so I could have done that.
Comfy.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, but I would have sat for another 2.5 hours to watch it on the IMAX. Yeah. It was mind-blowing. Yeah. And it was everything that I wanted the original to be as well. You know what I mean? Like, it just was... Here you're talking about a film that no one ever did a sequel of because everyone was terrified of it. Because... Yeah. No one's quite... I'm still not quite sure how Ridley Scott makes that original film. Like,
I mean, have you seen the 3-hour documentary?
No, and I really should, because
100% you need to watch
it.
Because
I was someone who didn't watch Blade Runner when it came out. Yeah, I watched it literally, like, I think it was shortly before I saw 2049.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was like, well, I better watch this quintessential film. I'm going to watch it. And I remember, I think I called you and I was like, how did he do that?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, it's to me, it's like miles above Alien. It's miles above everything else. It's like you created this world that no one can replicate, and that no one did for a long time except through reference. You know, there was never a Blade Runner sequel. There were all these things that looked just like Blade Runner.
Or were trying to look like
Exactly. Blade Runner.
Yeah. So, and it wasn't really until The Matrix, Dark City, when they kind of succeeded in doing something a little bit different.
Right? Yeah, that's what I mean. 100%. I just found it's really funny. I've read the book for a long time. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? That's one of my favorite Philip K. Dick stories. Yeah,
you mentioned that.
So that's why I was like laughing at this. And it's nothing like the story. That's why Ridley Scott was known for being able to look at Philip Dick's stories and kind of pull take them into something action-y, something cooler. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. So, But yeah, I mean, if he does what he did with 2049, I mean, that was it was another good Ryan Gosling film.
Yeah,
I want to hate that guy because he's always so pretty.
And I was freaking love him.
See, I said that, like, so fucking pretty. But like, but man, he's so good.
I love him to death. I think he's hilarious as well. He needs to do more comedies.
What comedy did I just watch him in? What has he been in comedy?
See, sometimes I do get confused with Ryan Reynolds, but right. But I'm pretty sure he's done
some. No, like, he has done some. Yeah, stuff, he definitely, mate. He's got chops.
He's got chops. But just the very last thing that I would want to kind of shout out, the music. I love the music. I love the big band.
Did you?
I love the musical choices. I thought it was it gave a definite New York vibe to Gotham, which I know is always been the case, right? Like, you know, the dark and gritty.
You say that. Mm. For me, and this is completely wrong, like, someone told me that Gotham was always supposed to be New York. To me, Metropolis was always New York. Mm. And then Gotham was Chicago.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's
Chicago, the case. Maybe it's just because of my views about the city. No, it's probably not. As I said, I'm pretty sure someone told me, because one of the old names for New York used to be Gotham.
It's interesting, though, because, like, a lot of, like,
The Dark Knight was shot all in
Chicago. So he was clearly trying to kind of...
And it just, the architecture there is a bit more... I mean...
Right. I could see that. But I guess just giving the city character...
Right. So it's funny. The first time I ran around any songs for that was when I was listening to Soundtracked on Spotify, and it used to open with the Mandos, why I had that on my playlist. And then the second song was The Stairways from The Joker, when he's walking up and down the stairs.
Yeah.
And it has that grand piano kind of stuff coming in and out. And it's not really Hans Zimmer, right? Mm. So it's not quite the... Hans Zimmer always has the... Like, I'm so sick of hearing it now because I know it's him. It's like... It's cool, but not like, once you get Hans Zimmer, then Christopher Nolan starts running down the street, and all of a sudden, like, you know exactly what you're seeing already.
And then he's exploding a nuclear bomb because he wants to explode.
I know, I love that meme you put on there. It was like, Ed sent me this meme. It's not ours. It's from the Facebook group that we're in, Movie Set Memes, and it was like, you know, they always do this, that scene from the second, it was Attack of the Clones, where Natalie Portman and Ryan Phillippe are trying to have this, not Ryan Phillippe. They're trying to have this romantic moment, and it bottled horribly.
But this was Kevin Nolan's head.
Put on to there being...
And it was, for my next film, I want a nuclear explosion. And then
Natalie Portman's like, you mean CGI, right?
I mean, like, as an effect, right? And then it's just him.
Just silence. And you can totally picture that, because you're like, yep, that'll be next. Like... Can we get our heads on a warhead? Like, how much would that cost? Would that be out of the budget? Or... And then all I said to Ed is like, he'll say that. And then be like, I want to shoot it on the moon, though. You know? Yeah. So that's what we mean. Like, oh, okay. Like, you know what I mean? Like, not quite like that, but... So, you know, all in all, this was a film I think every indie filmmaker should watch, because it's a good film.
Yeah.
It has its qualms, and you've heard about those. Those are... How you overcome those is by making a film like this. Mm. So you don't really care about the fact that the clowns in the background never really amounted to anything.
No. And again, I feel like it's almost like, well, we need to create an environment so that we can put in the Wayne's death.
I was about to say, query, when was this released? So when did this come
2019.
Out? So that's the other thing. Like, I wonder, and I might have read about this somewhere and forgotten up until this point, you know, we talked about Falcon and Winter Soldier. They had to cut a really big part of the story out because it just was too on the nose.
Yeah.
And they just knew, as I said, Sweet Tooth did it and died a horrible death.
Right.
You know, this, you know, they did it in Falcon and Winter Soldier and made it kind of a background thing, and all of a sudden it was like, okay.
Yeah.
That's not a big deal. But, query. Okay. So you have all these clown scenes in there, and you have maybe some more connecting scenes in there. It was a pretty long film to begin with. It was already 2 hours and something.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe you've got another 20 minutes of showing how he... You know, a bit more like The Dark Knight, because The Dark Knight, he does a similar thing. He's got all the clowns are with him. It's just, it's his gang, like his criminal organization. So maybe there were more scenes showing how he turns the crowd with him. There is that scene where obviously he's in the clown parade and all that thing. But I wonder if someone turns to Todd and says, no, like, absolutely not. We can't put these extra scenes in right now. Like... We can't focus on that at all.
Maybe.
So just maybe to throw a lifeline out there. Because it just...
Especially like kind of in the last minutes. Like you say, maybe they even
Because it's odd for a film to be so well made like that, but then just have those loose ends that you're like, where did this come from? You know what I mean? Yeah. And I don't think it was deliberate. It just didn't... It seemed too loose to be deliberate, you know?
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that as a possibility.
Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, soundtrack is awesome. Mm. Hans Zimmer with the boom, not there, but it does have a gradual, like you said, almost decay to it.
Mm.
You know,
More so the kind of the big band music and the bits of rock music that they put in there. I just thought it was really, really good choices. Again, very Martin Scorsese, right? Like you think about Goodfellas and the great music choices for that, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the thing. Like, it's course, the funny thing is, Scorsese's not even in the credits on any of this. Did he have anything to do with this film?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
Todd Phillips has to be his greatest understudy ever made.
I think he's probably like a lot of people of that generation, you know, a big fan of that style of filmmaking, and I think he did more than an adequate job of recreating that vibe, that feel.
No, it's fine. You know, the last thing I'll think about is, it's funny to me, because the English equivalent to me is like Guy Ritchie, but then Guy Ritchie only ever did a couple films that worked that well, where Scorsese just nailed it every single time. But that same kind of grit, dirt, and grainy, that's your Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, that's your, you know, everybody's favorite Snatch.
Mm.
That's what that makes those films so good, is that all of a sudden it kind of takes it down to the street level. You're like...
And it's ironic that since then he's kind of been chasing that vibe.
He has. Rock and Roller, The Gentleman, all adequate films, but never as indie, never as like, you know, it's a bit like Kasabian to me.
That kind of energy,
like,
yeah, that kind of like...
You know, just like...
It feels a little punk music, I think. You know, in its kind of like you say, that desire to...
It is. I mean, that's what makes Scorsese interesting, is he's this Oscar-winning... You know, I noticed that with Gangs of New York is my favorite film by him, because I just love that story. And
I really, really like Gangs of New York.
Yeah, I love that film. Love that film. But it's...
Stylistically, it's my favorite of his.
And it has some punk rock elements in it, though. That's what I always love about him, is he's not afraid to do these, like, fast cuts or fast whatevers, you know, where they look completely out of place in an Oscar film like that. That's like 2 hours something long, but... For him, that's how he makes his film. So, yeah, I just love it. Anyways, we will wrap this up now, guys. We've been talking for a good chunk of time, and poor Eddie, I'm sure, has to get to somewhere tomorrow.
Hitting 1 hour 15. So
yeah, there
good.
We go. It's good, mate. So next week, we're going to see if we can get the illustrious Mitch Bain on. I'm going to drop him a line to see if he wants to come on. We also, as I said, in the future, we'll have Ashley McCarthy coming on, along with Matthias as well. I have to get back with him. So we've got a bunch of guests coming on. We'll probably circle around some of the old guests and see if they want to come back again. But sure. Otherwise,
also, like, we're both planning on watching Shang-Chi this week,
so we'll get that in. Yeah, we'll maybe definitely we'll get an episode in. Of Shang-Chi in it, or not an episode, we'll definitely get a discussion on Shang-Chi in at some point. As I said, Candyman, I can talk about more if someone wants to hear, if I didn't mention it in the last podcast and you want to hear more about it. But otherwise, we will catch you next week with more Tales from the Road, Tales of what we're watching, Tales of what's inspiring us these days. And until then, thank you so much for listening, listeners, and bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.